And welcome back. With every passing day, numerous species in Africa are closer to extinction. There's an ongoing international effort to protect endangered wildlife, and our next guest is heavily involved in this work, especially the endangered animals in North and West Africa. Conservation biologist John Newby co-founded the Sahelo Saharan Interest Group, and in 2005 was named Chief Executive Officer of the Sahara Conservation Fund, or SFC, an international NGO established to conserve the wildlife of the Sahara. He is a close partner of the St. Louis Zoo's Saharan Wildlife Recovery Center and is a conservation fellow with the zoo's Wild Care Institute. John Newby joins me in studio. Great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome, Don.
There are a couple of things I'd like to talk about aside from why you're here. And that is, I saw something over the weekend that I found most disturbing. Maybe you saw it too. And that is in Denmark, the case of them shooting the giraffe in the zoo in front of children, dismembering it and feeding it to the lions. What in the world did you think of that?
Well, I think it was badly handled, quite frankly. I think one has to look at the details to understand why the culling of that animal was necessary. And I don't have a particular opinion because I don't know the case well enough to judge. But if culling of an animal, killing of an animal becomes necessary for whatever reason, one does it in a way as humanely and as well as possible. And certainly you don't do it in front of people who would be sensitive to such a happening.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine what those kids were experiencing when they watched this going on.
Absolutely. I think it would be quite traumatic for them.
There was also a piece in the paper this morning talking about the elite in China eating tigers and what a problem this is. I mean, these are things that are just popping out of the news all of a sudden.
Yeah, the traditional Asian medicine market, for example, has been around for a very, very long time. It's deeply ingrained in Chinese society. And as you know yourself, education often takes a very, very long time to bear the fruits that we would like to see. It is of critical concern, the traditional Chinese medicine market. And there, a lot of work is being done. And I do believe the younger generation of Chinese are looking more broadly beyond their own frontiers and beyond their own traditional interests and recognizing the impact, which in the past hasn't been the case.
That they apparently feel if they eat tiger meat, they will be endowed with the strength of the tiger and the other attributes.
Absolutely. And it's the same in Africa. There is a traditional medicine market, if you like, which is based on animal products, such as the ostrich, for example. Ostrich long legs runs fast, so therefore ostrich grease and the marrow of the bone is used in traditional medicines for rheumatism and arthritis, and one draws those linkages.
Yeah, and then one can get into the aphrodisiacs and things with rhino horns and things of this nature.
Absolutely, absolutely.
It's a big business, isn't it?
It's a big business. I mean, it's a multi-billion business. Some say that it is the third most lucrative illegal trade is wildlife trade.
Hmm. Well, that brings us to your neck of the woods. And how much time do you spend in Africa?
About 6 months a year.
Yeah. And what is the situation there? What are your concerns about the endangered wildlife in the Sahara region?
There are a number of concerns. I think the prime concern that really was behind the establishment of the Sahara Conservation Fund was in the conservation and general communities, there is a total lack of interest or information even about the Sahara and the biodiversity that lives there. The Sahara is not, as most people imagine, a barren wasteland. There is, in fact, quite a lot of life there. A life that is exquisitely adapted to dealing with the rigors of heat and drought. Mm. Many of the species that are there have been ignored by the conservation community and are really in dire straits, including some of the larger animals, some of the largest animals, in fact.
Why are they in dire straits? What's happening?
Overhunting primarily has been the big cause, and that has accelerated over the last 100 years with the introduction of modern firearms and four-wheel drive vehicles which can go anywhere.
And hunting safaris, that sort of thing? I mean, is this still going on?
There has been a little bit of that. I wouldn't say that overall it was the major impact. There are pockets where that still exists. There are pockets where traditional falconry takes place. I say traditional. It isn't really no longer traditional because the falconers are using high-tech methods to find the birds that they're after. And there's a lot of collateral damage in terms of gazelles, which also inhabit the same areas.
You'd mentioned the ostriches before, and I know that is one of the areas of which you have a particular concern. Is the fact that this population is dwindling primarily the result of what you had mentioned a few moments ago, the medicinal qualities that some people feel they have?
I think to a certain extent that is the case. Whenever an ostrich was hunted in the past, for example, the bone marrow and the fat, the grease of the ostrich, would be collected for sale into that market, but the meat was also consumed. There wasn't, since the Middle Ages, there hasn't been a real trade in ostrich feathers, nor in northern Africa for the skin of the ostrich, which is not the case perhaps in southern Africa. But also the eggs are consumed, and generally speaking, if you add the hunting pressure on top of things like periodic drought and desertification that is taking place or has been taking place over the last 100 years or so, cumulatively, it's quite a lethal cocktail of impacts.
Is climate change having any impact at all?
It's a good question, because the scientists are still really working out the impact for the Sahara. Some people say that the parts of the Sahara are going to get drier, but other people are saying that whilst parts of the Sahara will get drier, parts of sub-Saharan Africa will in fact get wetter.
How large an area are we talking about? I tend to think of the Sahara Desert as being a massive, huge part of the African continent.
Yes, it is. I mean, it's about 4 million square miles.
That's big.
Which is mainland USA. And it's shared by 13, 14 countries, depending on how you cut those countries up, ecologically or eco-regionally. So it's a big area, and it's a complex area. Politically, it's complex. Linguistically, it can be complex. Sociologically, it can be quite complex. So not only are we faced by ecological and biodiversity issues, but we're faced also with a whole palette of other issues which complicate work there.
Well, how do you go about saving the ostrich?
If I knew, I think we would have already done it.
Well, you're working on it. I assume you have some ideas.
We do indeed. Yeah. In many cases where the bird has completely disappeared, the only tool we have in our toolbox is reintroduction and restoration. And that is what we're doing in the Republic of Niger, where the bird has been extinct in that country for the last 50 years now. The goal of our project there is to work with a local non-governmental organization to build their capacity to breed and multiply the ostriches to the extent that we will have birds of a suitable age to release back into the wild under community protection. We're going to see how that works, and then if the results are positive, then use that as a test bed for further reintroductions back into the wild.
And is the effort complicated by the fact that there are so many countries potentially involved? You talk about more than a dozen countries. Is that an issue?
Not really, because I think to be successful, one thing I've learned in these 40 years is that there's no one size fits all, and that one really needs to look very, very carefully at the local opportunities and the local potential to do a certain thing, build up a relationship. Relationships are very important in Africa. It's not what you know, it's who you know, and the quality of that knowing is really important. And so working at a smaller scale and being successful with one community isn't necessarily a blueprint for working successfully in any other area. So one really needs to look very carefully at the details.
What is the St. Louis Zoo's role in all of this?
That is also a very good question, one that's asked me all the time. The St. Louis Zoo historically has held in its collection a number of species which came from the Sahara. It's also a conservation leader in the zoo community, in the zoo movement. And as you probably know, many zoos are now working towards adding a solid and meaningful conservation portfolio to their other activities related more directly with the traditional rules of zoos, of keeping animals, of displaying animals. So St. Louis Zoo, in fact, was one of the co-founders of the Sahara Conservation Fund. This was based on personal contacts. It was also based on the fact that a number of species are being held at the zoo, that the zoo was already contributing to captive breeding of these species, and was really keen to get involved in the conservation in the wild of the remaining animals left in Africa. And so since there was virtually no other conservation organization doing that, and seeing the need and the niche, St. Louis Zoo jumped in and helped us found the Sahara Conservation Fund.
It would seem that this would be a must kind of project for zoos all over this country and all over the world, as a matter of fact.
And it is increasingly recognized. Last week I was at the American Zoos and Aquariums Association's meeting in Memphis, Tennessee, and one of the key messages that came out of that meeting is not only does the zoo movement in the United States have the potential to do more conservation work, but really must become more active in conservation. And this is happening.
Let's go back to the ostrich for a moment.
Sure.
What happens if the ostrich population disappears from the African continent?
Well, that, again, the ostrich acts as a flagship in many ways. It's an iconic species. And if one can devise conservation programs and especially conservation messages around this animal, it helps raise awareness for a whole bunch of other biodiversity issues which may go unnoticed, notably habitat conservation, because we're not going to conserve the ostrich without conserving the habitat. Now, by and large, the people we work with, the pastoralists, recognize the value of the habitat rather more than they do recognize mm-hmm. the value of the ostrich. So if the ostrich is a way, we clearly have biodiversity concerns as a conservation organization. But the question is finding the right message which will help us propel conservation of ostriches into a meaningful framework that the local people and local communities can contribute to and understand where we're coming from. So I think in the case of the ostrich, the habitat issue is the best issue. It's the best entry point because everybody recognizes the value of a healthy habitat because most of the people are living off the land in any case.
Well, just for the sake of this discussion, let me put this to you. The dodo is extinct, as we all know. And, you know, everything seems to proceed okay. We're doing okay now without the dodo.
Mm-hmm.
We do okay without the ostrich.
Well, you're possibly so. There's a degree of redundancy, I suppose, in any system. It's a bit like the jigsaw puzzle. You know, you lose one piece of the jigsaw puzzle, you can still see the picture. Maybe if you lose 10 pieces, you see the picture. But if you start losing 20 pieces, and especially the important edge pieces and corner pieces, then you start losing the whole structure, and that's the whole point. The more we pull the web of life apart, the more likely it is to unravel. And when it unravels, we unravel with it.
Okay, we're not talking about jigsaw puzzle pieces here, but we are talking about wildlife. And the ostrich is not your only concern. The other pieces that would be involved are some of the other creatures that you are concerned about. What are they?
Well, I'll mention two species because they can be seen at St. Louis Zoo. One is the Addax antelope. There are about 300 of these left in the wild today. Mm. So it makes it one of the rarest animals on Earth. St. Louis Zoo is contributing by managing a population of these. The second species that you can see at the zoo is the Dharma gazelle, which is also critically endangered, of which there are about 300 left in the wild. And Sahara Conservation Fund has programs focusing on both those species. And it's really good for us to be able to mention the existence of these animals in captivity because it gives us leverage with the general public as well. I don't know if you've seen the exhibits at the zoo for the Addax and the Dharma gazelle, but the interpretation that goes along with those exhibits also allows us to transmit those messages to the public that are interested in knowing a little bit more about these species and why the zoo is holding them.
If there are only 300 of each of these animals left on the planet, is there any realistic chance of preserving them? And that's not very many.
Well, certainly if we did nothing, there would be no realistic chance of doing anything. So there is a chance. I think since we've been active for the last nearly 10 years now, we started about 2005. Over those 10 years, we have been able to stabilize the decline in both those species, which is already a good thing to have done. It's taken a lot of time. It's taken a lot of effort. And to maintain that stabilization, let alone build up numbers again, is going to take more time and effort. But it's one of those things that if we don't get engaged and really try and do something about it, there is no doubt that not only would those species disappear, but others will go along with it.
Give me, if you would, John, some sense of what your day is like when you are there and you're doing your work. How does your day unfold?
Very early. The African morning is the best time of the day, no doubt about it. After that, in the Sahara, it gets hot very, very quickly, and we're up in the 110, 120 very rapidly. I myself am a field worker. The organization I work for is very much a field-based organization, so we're in the field. We're trying to, as far as possible, build up our knowledge base of the animals. So we're doing wildlife inventory work. We're looking at where the animals are. We're interfacing all the time with the local people that we meet. And many of the people we meet are nomads, the pastoralists that live with their livestock in the same areas. And we're trying all the time to work out how best to conserve the animals that we see. I've just come back from Chad. A great trip. We were able to see these Dharma gazelles. We were able to talk with the local communities about how they might participate in efforts to conserve these animals. So that, again, would be a typical part of my day. But at the end of that trip, just to show you the other extreme of the spectrum, at the end of that trip, I was asked by the Minister of the Environment to give him feedback so that he, the next day, could go and see the president of the country to give him feedback on what the situation was. So clearly this idea of connectivity, of building information base on the ground and then transmitting it through the system to the decision makers at the top, I think you really need that kind of holistic approach to move forwards.
And dealing with the nomads and the people you would run into in the bush, I'm using terms that I'm not sure I fully understand or use correctly, but in any case, in dealing with these people, do they fully understand and appreciate what you're doing and recognize the need that someone do it?
They certainly recognize what we're doing because the nomads tend to depend almost exclusively on natural resources, on grazing, on water, on rainfall. They have a profound understanding of the living world around them. They notice the disappearance of these species. Many of the species are iconic to them. So although they feel fairly powerless about doing anything about it, they do recognize the loss of certain species. Some of them are very powerful species. Some of the Adax antelope, for example, or the oryx, for example, very, very powerful species within their own cultures. So although they regret the disappearance of these animals, they feel fairly powerless about doing anything about it. I think when you ask them what their main priorities are, certainly wildlife conservation is not one of them, which is obvious. I mean, they have much, much more profound needs.
But are they eliminating some of that population themselves for food?
They certainly were part of that. Yes, absolutely.
But any more?
No. The major threat today is from the legal bearers of arms. The people who are legally allowed to carry guns and legally allowed to drive around. Most of the nomads, their hunting in the past and even their hunting today is very artisanal. It's using spears, it's using horses, it's using dogs. And those levels of offtake were always sustainable by the wild populations. What isn't sustainable is a truckload of soldiers or a truckload of gendarmes who turn up and just basically blow away anything they see.
Well, that brings to mind another issue in that part of the world and in various parts of that part of the world. And as much of it is in turmoil much of the time. And you have to work around that, I assume.
Yes, it's a pretty turbulent situation. Mm-hmm. But I think we shouldn't fall into the trap of assuming that just because there are problems in one place, that you have the same problems everywhere. The Sahara is a huge place. And there are some hot spots that we stay well away from because it just wouldn't be safe, it wouldn't be realistic to work there. But there are other areas where we can work. And one of the things that we've understood very, very clearly is that one of the solutions to the instability in the Sahara is building local capacity. Mm-hmm. The people, the local communities, the local forest service, the local wildlife service, they're not going anywhere. And if we can build their capacity, they can do the work that we're currently doing. Currently, they don't have the wherewithal to do the job. So if the more we invest in their development and their capacity building, the more we have a better insurance policy for places and times where we ourselves cannot be directly active in the field. We'll always have a role to play because this international outreach, conservation is really international business, and you need that international outreach, you need that international support for fundraising, and all of that. So I think there's always going to be a job for us. But unless we put the emphasis on building local capacity, we're really not addressing the sustainability of conservation in any way, shape, or form.
Have to have a healthy nucleus for everything else to thrive.
Absolutely.
What sort of punishment is meted out to these people who just destroy this wildlife?
Well, it varies from country to country and place to place. Two examples. The Republic of Niger has a fairly lax wildlife law. It's good at creating laws, but it doesn't really have much capacity to implement them. The Republic of Chad, on the other hand, which is a neighboring country where we work, has strong law and strong implementation. So the political message, last year the president of Chad came out and said, I don't want to see any more military hunting. He comes from a military background. He has a lot of military clout, and the hunting has stopped.
Just like that, just by a decree.
Just by a decree and personal commitment on his part. However, carrot and stick, I do know that poachers and hunters in Chad have been sent away for prison for lengthy periods. In Niger, the people may get let free for nothing or a $5 fine.
Well, consistency would seem to be something that has to be striven for to be effective.
Certainly, yes, yeah. Exactly. But as I said, it's a big part of the world, many countries, and
including our own, and including our St. Louis Zoo being a part of all of this.
Absolutely, and playing a fantastic role, I might add.
Well, we're glad to hear that. John Newby, thanks so much for being with us. John Newby is Chief Executive Officer of Sahara Conservation Fund and Conservation Fellow at the St. Louis Zoo Wild Care Institute. It's been a pleasure meeting you, and good luck when you back in Africa with the work you're doing.
Thank you, Don.
Thank
My
you,
pleasure.
John Newby. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll take a look at a couple of the local school board races and advance of next week's elections. And we'll also discuss the role of school boards and what voters should look for in candidates. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.